It's a wonderful year. It's a wonderful date. And the family's here to celebrate. Oh, it's fine to be known as great, great, great. I'm 104 today. The mail's on its way and the vicar's been and the girl from the ladies' magazine. The telegram here from the dear young queen. I'm 104 today. I'm 104. I may be more. There was nobody left who has kept the score. I was just a girl. Remember well the first Trafalgar day. Surrounded by my kith and kin. I'm waiting for the party to begin. The table's full of din, din, din. So get those damn reporters in and tell him I owe it all to Jim. I'm 104 today. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, isn't it amazing to think that in the 1950s, when Flanders and Swann wrote that song, they could refer to the dear young queen. And the dear young queen, very sadly, has departed. And I have been asked if I might give my feelings on the issue of the Queen's parting and what she means to me, and that I propose to do. But before doing that, a quick word from our sponsor.
Before we start, I'd just like to say a word about our sponsor, and that is Atlas VPN. Now, here's the situation, chaps. We are all truth seekers here at the Jolly Heretic Public House. We all want to know the truth about the world, and the only way we can do that is if we get lots of different perspectives, lots of alternative perspectives. And we are in a situation where we cannot get that. The internet is censored, everything is censored, and we literally cannot get the other side with regard to certain important events that are happening in the world because of the way that they censor the internet. So the only thing to do, as far as I'm concerned, is to use a VPN. And Atlas VPN is currently running a huge discount. It means you can get a 3-month subscription for just $1.83 a month, plus 3 months for free, with a 30-day money-back guarantee. And so time is running out, so it's worth looking into, really. There's lots and lots of benefits to this. Not only is that you've got that deal, but you could unlock your favourite content from all over the world. You know, shows from friends or whatever it is you like are using Atlas VPN. You can keep your Google searches private. They make sure that your results aren't tracked and so forth. You can stop ads and malware. It's more than just a VPN. It blocks malicious links and ads and so forth. And it notifies you when someone's trying to steal your data. And you can save money online. It notifies you of the best deals. And it can protect unlimited devices. So it seems to be a jolly good idea. And as I say, they've currently got this campaign where it's just $1.83 a month. So, you know, it's worth thinking about. $1.83 a month for a 3-year subscription, plus 3 months for free with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Time is running out, so, you know, it's certainly worth looking into. So as a person that is in favour of the truth and wants as much as many different perspectives as possible and is finding these blocked by our current system, I think getting a VPN is worth doing. And as far as I can see, Atlas VPN is where it's at, chaps.
Okay, back to the video. So, the Queen. I rather regret the fact that I never met the Queen. The nearest I got to it was in about 1984. I did a really good picture of one of those guardsmen that stands outside Buckingham Palace. And my mother said to me, "Oh, that's really good. You should send that to the Queen." I was very excited, so we sent it to the Queen. And eventually we got a letter back from one of her ladies-in-waiting, the Countess of something or other. These days you probably get a letter back from some person whose sole job is to answer letters to the Queen. But those days, from the lady-in-waiting, the Countess of something, saying, "Oh, Her Majesty is very grateful for the picture and she's asked me to pass on to you how happy she is and how thankful she is for it," of course. Of course, it was nonsense. But it made me feel very good when I was 4 years old. The second opportunity was when I was at Durham University. It must have been about April or May 2002, and she came to Durham. And I remember that her car drove right in front of me, right past me, with the Royal Standard on the front of the car. Fine. And then I couldn't be bothered to wait in the Market Square. It took so long for her to manifest that I just couldn't be buggered and went home. And then when the people that had waited came back, they were so excited. They were so excited. We saw her. They were so excited to have seen the Queen. I did know some people that knew the Queen. My auntie Ethel, my great auntie, her son was in charge of rugby union in the UK. And on that basis, he used to get invited to garden parties. And he used to take his mother with him, who was a widow. And so she met the Queen a number of times, and was, again, there was the comment that she was so friendly and she made you feel that you were really wanted and that she was really interested in you. And also I was friends with a lady who was the mayor of Merton, and she met the Queen in her capacity as mayor of Merton and sat next to her for an hour or so at a dinner and informed me what a lovely, kind, inquisitive, funny, you know, lady she was. So in generally then, the view of the Queen is positive as an individual. But I think that I'm more interested in the Queen in terms of what she represents, and the monarchy in terms of what it represents, what it means. Because I've done a lot of research on this, and I've looked at this in a lot of videos, this idea that certain nations survive in the battle of group selection with other nations. And what are the nations that survive? They are nations that are high in positive and negative ethnocentrism. And what is it then that those have in common? It is that they sanctify nationalism. They sanctify positive and negative ethnocentrism as the will of God or the will of the gods. And they render their political leaders essentially semi-divine. They say that the gods have placed these political leaders, the queen or the king or whatever, in place. And therefore, they are not to be questioned, and they are to be, in a way, worshipped. And they act in almost as living gods that hold the nation together and hold together the nation's sense of eternity. There is nothing eternal about the Finnish president or the Finnish presidency. He is a political figure. But there is something, it's difficult to put it in other words, there is something eternal and therefore central to nationalism and of religious value about the monarchy. There is this idea that the monarchy reaches back into English history such a long way that it's back to a time when nobody can remember any different. It is a constant connection with the past. It is a constant connection with a kind of before time, a kind of romantic before time, which is almost nebulous, almost like almost how the Greeks, the classical Greeks, saw Troy as this semi-divine before time. And it connects us back into that, and it sanctifies, therefore, the system of national identity as something eternal, as something you don't question, as something that gives a kind of eternal meaning to your life. And the monarchy is symbolic of that, and the Queen as a person then becomes symbolic of that kind of relationship with history. The idea that we as English people are not individuals, we are but members of a great chain that stretches all the way back to the time of the Saxons, when the Saxons invaded England and made it their own. And that the monarchy, the Queen is directly descended from Cerdic, King of Wessex, who in the 500s, she is directly descended from, so all of us probably, but she is directly descended from this person and has inherited from this person that mantle of kinship. And so it brings into its own this idea that you have in many successful ethnocentric societies, that you don't think about yourself. You think about the good of the group. You worship ancestors because the ancestors are the reason why you are here, the reason why you exist, the reason why your group hasn't been destroyed by another group. And you instill the future generations with the values of those of those ancestors, such that your life is not about being happy. It's not about being happy with yourself or having a sense of contentment or anything like that. It's about taking the values that allow a civilization and a people, your kin, your eternally sanctified, special, divinely inspired group, your people. It's taking those ideas and passing them on to their successors so that hopefully the English people last forever. And so you sanctify Englishness, and you have this connection within the nature of England all the way back deep into history, this religious connection to a before time, to a kind of pagan time, which we can barely and dimly remember. And we've always had the monarchy. And so there, we've always had various strands of this family in charge. And therefore their presence as the head of state, is this relationship with something eternal, with something unchanging, with something mysterium tremendum et fascinans, with something that kind of sacred. And we know deep down that it isn't. I mean, we know deep down that these are just people and so on. But it's there's something mesmerizing about it. There's something like when a person prays or is hypnotized or whatever, they can enter an alternative state and this religious experience, something like that, which can motivate them and can allow them to get through life and be more successful in life. We know that religiousness correlates with being more successful. It correlates with fertility, it correlates with happiness, it correlates with mental and physical health and so on. And I think that that kind of sanctification of history, to which the monarchy is central because they are a flesh and blood example of something that basically seems eternal about English history, can put you in that kind of mood where you can think to yourself, yes, I have a purpose in life, and my purpose is to be English, and is to ensure that the English prosper and the English triumph. One realm of races four, and that the English go on forever. And that this in the monarch symbolizes all of that, because the monarch is personally part of a chain that goes all the way back over 1500 years into the dim past, where the Dark Ages, from which we emerged, where records are unclear. And so I think that is why, as the best as I can articulate it, the reaction is like it is, because she brings, and also more recently, I mean, as an individual, the Queen has been on the throne so long, and the country has changed so dramatically that then she is a connection to another England, a better England. The England that John Betjeman articulates in poems, the England of the 20s and 30s, where people trusted each other and people knew each other. And okay, it wasn't ever quite like that. I mean, it's a romanticisation of the past to think that it was as good as that. But there is some sense in which she is a connection as a person to a more united England, to an England which is kind of dying off, to an England which we're struggling to keep going. And she has a personal connection to that, and she's been there all the way through it. Now, so that's why I think the monarchy is worth having, because it sanctifies the nation state. It renders the nation state something religious. It renders the nation state something that has a link, a physical link, an embodied link to a kind of dim and distant past. And it kind of sanctifies in that sense the notion of ancestor worship and a worship of history and a worship of our own people. And we know that is something which more successful groups do. They sanctify themselves, they sanctify their ancestors as brilliant and as outsiders as something else. In addition, an obvious benefit to the monarchy, I mean, it's been set up by Thomas Hobbes, that if you have a ruling class can become disconnected from the people. People can go into the parliament in order to enrich themselves. They might not align with the people. They might make out like bandits while they have a brief period in power. But no, the monarch is in power for all of the monarch's life. And so the monarch is not going to make out like a bandit in this way. If the nation fails, then the monarch is absolutely going to fail and be overthrown. So the monarch has a reason to behave him or herself and to look after the interests of the nation. Being the monarch is a religious position, a religiously sanctified position. And so the monarch will genuinely believe, and I think the Queen genuinely believed, that she must, it is God's will, that she must act in the interests of her people. The monarch can be given wise counsel in secrecy. This cannot happen in an assembly. A rhetoric can trump reason in an assembly. You have many people, you have more opportunities for leaks. The monarch will be long-term, and therefore it can do things long-term, whereas an assembly will be short-termist. an assembly can disagree out of the wrong reasons for envy or whatever, but a monarch can't really do that. A monarch will have a few flatterers, an assembly of 600 people will have hundreds of flatterers, so therefore that's another problem. So the assembly is kind of a permanent infant king. There's always intrigue, there's always ambitious people trying to get power, whereas the monarch gives you a sort of stability. On a personal level, I wish that I can see why she didn't, but I wish the Queen had used some of the powers that she does in theory have. There are three times that I wish she had done so. The first time was when Tony Blair came to power in 1997 and started tinkering with the law, got rid of double jeopardy, got rid of the House of Lords, brought in basically being guilty until proven innocent in terms of cases of racism, this sort of thing. Well, that's a serious problem, and I think that the Queen would have been within her rights to just say, I will not give royal assent to these laws. Now, I can see why she didn't, because when Edward VIII started trying to interfere in government policy, there was pressure placed upon him, and he had to abdicate, and that would have been fresh in her mind. She only became Queen because of the abdication of Edward VIII, and therefore her father becoming king. And also 97, that kind of time, was when the royal family weren't that popular. It was just after the death of Princess Diana, so they had to be careful. They were certainly much more popular by 2009, when almost all of the members of Parliament in the UK were found to be corrupt and were found to have been fiddling their expenses. And I think that the Queen would have had the people's support if she had just, as she can do in theory, if she had just dissolved Parliament and said that anyone that has any wrongdoing in terms of expenses claims cannot stand in the forthcoming election. I think that would have been reasonable, and she would have had the people's support. And the third instance, I think, would have been in the debate, the appalling situation with regard to the referendum on Brexit, of which we know she was in favour of Brexit, where Parliament was behaving appallingly. Parliament was obstructing the democratic will of the British people, and I think that she could have just dissolved Parliament there and then. And I think that there would have been good reason to do that. But I can see why she didn't do that. It was that very stability that made her such a respected person that would mean that she wouldn't behave in that kind of way. But it's, of course, terribly sad that she has gone. But there is this continuity. There is this sudden feeling. Only last night I was interviewing Wanjiru Nagoya, and I broke the news to her beforehand that the Queen had died. And I'd always thought to myself, oh, it's going to be chaos when the Queen dies. The country's going to fall apart. But it's amazing how quickly, when you hear that word, the King, that suddenly Charles stops being the Charles that we've all mocked for wanting to be Camilla's tampon or tampax or whatever it is. And suddenly he just takes on that mantle, that religious mantle, that sort of divine-seeming mantle of kingship. And he is the King. And then you stop thinking about these things. Suddenly he has an aura that shines from his mother. Suddenly he is the King, and he is part of this great chain that goes all the way back to the Dark Ages, that goes all the way back to a time when we forget about, and becomes part of this kind of quasi-religious system, which gives a great sense of sort of sacral meaning to a lot of English people. So I think that it actually is going to be all right. I think we can say, God save the King, and we can say that he will, I think, successful. I don't know if Britain is in decline or whatever, but at least it will be in decline with this vague sense of its own sacredness, with this vague sense of its own, of the importance of ancestors and doing right by the ancestors, and with this vague sense of something eternal. Which I think is that's the crucial thing that the monarchy gives you, which you don't get in presidency. It's something religious and something eternal, which holds the nation together. As Clifford Geertz said, religion is a system of symbols and so on that seem to those that accept them uniquely realistic. And at times like this, that's how the monarchy seems, because it is this flesh and blood expression of something, if not eternal, then something of the ages. this royal throne of kings, this sceptred isle, the earth of majesty, this seat of Mars, this other Eden, demi-paradise, this fortress built by nature for herself against infection and the hand of war, this happy breed of men, this little world, this precious stone set in the silver sea, which serves it in the office of a wall or as a moat, defensive to a house against the envy of less happier lands, this blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England.
Hello, hello, hello! The Jolly Heretic is an online public house which meets on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 PM UK time, 2 PM New York, in which we discuss the kind of based, fearless science which is increasingly expunged from our woke, joke universities. If you would like to help the Jolly Heretic public house, and there are many ways you can do so, please, please, please become one of my patrons on Subscribestar. Also, if you want to, you can donate to the channel using Odyssey and Entropy, and you could also purchase Jolly Heretic merchandise, such as shirts and mugs. All of the links are in the description. Again, I'd be most violently grateful if you could assist the Jolly Heretic Public House, and I will see you all soon, and goodbye!